Not only are there lots of genes, but there's on and off switches, things in the outside world that will activate a particular gene to produce its protein product, all that sort of thing. And it turns out epigenetics, what epigenetics is about is early experience can cause a permanent stage of a switch being held on all the time or being held off all the time. And what Meany pioneered in showing is that mothering style causes certain epigenetic changes in the brain having to do with what sort of glucocorticoid levels there'll be in adulthood. It's still not clear how you get from licking to this epigenetic stuff. The nuts and bolts are getting worked out these days. How you do that, but at least it's understood now how differences in prenatal, postnatal experience produce propensities towards certain genes being more active than others or less active. Remarkable finding in the last few years. Go to those Dutch hunger winter adults, the human ones, and look at certain key genes in them, and there have been those epigenetic changes. What sorts of genes, not genes coding for eye color or how wide their feet are, any genes having to do with insulin actions. Perfect, exactly what you would expect. So what we see here is the way in which experience, prenatal and postnatal, can shape the sort of hormonal profile you have as an adult, the sort of brain you have, early experience taking the form of severe stress, but also mild stress, and degrees of stimulation and mothering style, producing different profiles in adulthood, producing, as we saw most remarkably, even profiles in the next generation and the next. Okay, it's right around this point where if you are a parent, you grind to a screeching neurotic halt because, like, here's a whole new realm in which you can screw up your kids. Okay, I have to do something confessional here, which is tell you a few of the ways in which my wife and I have been horrible, horrible parents. There was the time when my wife was pregnant with our first child, our son, during the third trimester, where we went to what turned out to be a really loud concert, and right in the middle of it, our son kicked. And we said, oh my God, we're stressing him, this auditory environmental stressor we have screwed up. Then there was the time that we meant to put on some video, one of those great educational ones, you know, like a video for four-year-olds about plate tectonics or something, and we messed up with the machine, and for about 15 seconds instead, there was some horrible, violent cartoon, and we messed up. Then there was the time, in order to placate my second child, our dog, we actually let her have some sugary cereal. Oh, we have messed up forever. We all know that neurosis, the notion that do something wrong with your child and there will be long-term consequences. Oh my God, that's crazy. You got to get this stuff under control. And then along comes this whole field saying experience, remarkably subtle differences in experience, beginning as a fetus, produce the sort of adult you will be. Produce perhaps even the sort of children you'll have, these long-term effects, these fetal origins of adult disease. So suddenly you get that much crazier as a neurotic parent. Look at the ways in which early experience has long-term consequences. Okay, so in response to all this neurosis, there's some bad news and some good news. Some of the bad news you've already heard, which is this a world only of extreme adverse experience versus everything else, you get a pretty normal outcome? No, we just saw that this covers the whole normal range of variability, amount of prenatal nutrition mapping onto adult metabolic profiles. So this is not just about them and their horrific parenting and prenatal lives. This is something that appears to apply across the whole range of development. Next source of bad news, which is how big are these effects? You know, if you're sort of a mainstream medicine type and you hear about stuff like this, the first response is that's ridiculous. There's no way stuff can work like this. And then when it is shown, yes, there are prenatal programming effects. The next sort of thing you do to kind of deny the importance is say, yes, 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 okay, I give up. It's for real. But these are not big effects. These can be enormous effects. the Dutch hunger winter phenomenon, as I mentioned, be a prenatally stressed Dutch fetus during that Dutch hunger winter, and your increased risk of metabolic syndrome, obesity, hypertension, diabetes, your increased risk 50 years later is not a tiny effect. It's almost a 20-fold increase. So we got bad news. Normative range of developmental experience produces a normal range of better or worse adult profiles, and these are big effects. These are not little hiccups of biology. But now the good news. How inevitable is this to occur if you were stressed prenatally for 3.5 minutes, you're going to pay a price? No, there's enormous amounts of variability from one individual to another. Developmental stress does not guarantee that you are up the creek in that way. And the other piece of good news is, are these things permanent? Prenatal stress, and suddenly are you guaranteed to have a miserable hyperglycemic 80th birthday? No. What's also clear is, amid the persistence of these effects, there's a tremendous capacity to reverse them throughout life. Okay, so we got some pluses and minuses. Now, as you think about this, what's the undercurrent of all this parental anxiety of, did I do too much of this and too little of that and all of this nutsiness? What's intrinsic in all of that after a while is, what's the optimal parenting style? And this is a domain of complete craziness. And you get some interesting insights into it when you look at work of, say, anthropologists who look at mothering styles as they vary cross-culturally. And there's differences. There's dramatic differences across cultures. How much physical contact does a baby spend with its mother? How much physical contact with non-mothers? How long on the average does a baby cry in this culture before it's picked up? At what age do babies stop sleeping with their mothers? Tremendous variability in that. So you look at this and suddenly you start thinking, well, if I can only learn enough about these cross-cultural patterns, I could come up with a perfect mothering style, which will have like the Trobriand Islander diet and the like a Turi Pygmy preschool curriculum and the Kwakiutl exercise regime. And it doesn't work that way. An anthropologist at Cornell named Meredith Small wrote a wonderful book that gets at this issue. And you look at all of the variability in parenting style across cultures, and what you realize is there's no optimal style. There's no style that is most natural, most embedded in our hominid history. What we do in culture after culture is we raise children to become the sort of adults that we value. And what you wind up seeing in our own society, in our own culture, is an example of this, one perfectly captured by this old Harry Chapin song, Cat's Cat in the Cradle, which is this yuppie and baby boomer song of middle-aged regret, which is, my boy grew up just like me.
Lecture 7, Stress, Growth, and Child Development.
Well, we're back. I've got on a new pair of socks and I'm freshly shaved, so ready for more. Part 2 of Stress and Growth. Now, you'll remember the main point of the previous lecture, amid our logic, chronic stress, bad news for growth, was the fact that environment does not begin at birth. That whole world of prenatal stress, that whole world of prenatal programming of adult metabolism, that was last lecture. What we'll emphasize here is growth not by way of signals from mom, but growth as experienced by the organism itself by way of stress. Okay, we know the logic once again, running away from the lion, blah, blah, chronic stress. How does this get turned into effects on growth? Because what you get after a while is precisely what seems logical, which is if you are a young organism and you are chronically stressed, you're not going to grow as fast. This is different from last lecture, chronic stress early in life, and when you're 70, things will be working differently. This is just the plain, straightforward world of lots of stress, and a kid doesn't grow as much. So what are some of the mechanisms underlying this? some very straightforward ones and ones that you could probably construct from lesson two, from the second lecture, going over the building blocks of the stress response. Very simple. Those elevated levels of glucocorticoids, that elevated activation of the sympathetic nervous system, the decreased secretion of growth hormone, put those together and that's where you've got problems with growth. Another one as well, back, remember the cardiovascular stress response. Not only do you want your blood pressure to go up to deliver energy to those thigh muscles, but in addition, you don't want to deliver blood to unessential areas, like your gut. We saw in the previous lecture how one consequence of that is if you are chronically stressed and chronically decreasing blood flow to your gut, it's more prone towards an ulcer. That whole picture. What we see here is if you were a kid and you were chronically decreasing blood flow to your gut, you're not absorbing nutrients as readily. So that's another mechanism by which you can disturb growth in kids thanks to chronic stress. Now, another question that seems to come up here over and over as we look at some of these adverse outcomes, how big of effects are these? Ooh, thanks to enormous amounts of childhood stress, you're 1/8 of an inch shorter than you would have been otherwise. No, these are not small, subtle effects. And at an extreme, you get one of the truly bizarre, disturbing outposts of medicine, a disease of kids who are so stressed that they stop growing entirely, termed stress dwarfism, also known as psychosocial dwarfism, psychogenic dwarfism, and this is for real. This is a child where there's no obvious disease, there's no malnutrition, there's no parasites. You look in the bloodstream and there's no growth hormone. You give them synthetic growth hormone, nothing happens, the whole system is shut down. And what you have here are the consequences of truly sustained adverse stress. You check around with that kid's background and out comes some appalling psychological stressor. And this is standard textbook knowledge. Get some textbook of endocrinology, look in the chapter on growth, and I guarantee you somewhere in there will be the obligatory picture of the stress dwarfism kid. You know those pictures, this is, you know, the stunted kid who's naked in front of the growth chart with a rectangle over the eyes, and then I guarantee you turn the page and you see the consequence of removing that child from that stressful setting. Technical term, you do a parentectomy on them. Get him into a different setting, you turn that page, and there's the same kid 2 years later, and they're like 6'14", and they're playing for the NBA, and you know, they're still naked with a rectangle, but everything else gets better. What we see here is the profound capacity of stress to disrupt growth and the remarkable capacity to recover from it. One dramatic example, and this was a paper that was published a few years ago about a child with stress dwarfism who wound up in New York Hospital, a child from a severely stressful psychological setting, and they showed when the child came into this pediatric ward, growth hormone levels were like at the floor. Over the next 3 months, he developed this close relationship with this one nurse. This was like the first normal emotional relationship of his life. By the end of those 3 months, he had perfectly normal levels of growth hormone. At that point, nurse goes on vacation. By the end of the 2-week vacation, the boy's back down to virtually zero. Nurse comes back from vacation, bounces back up. Think about it. Think about it, the rate at which this child was depositing calcium in his bones could be predicted by just how loved and safe he was feeling in the world. You can't ask for a much better example that what's going on here affects every outpost in the body. So we have stress dwarfism. The question then becomes one of magnitude, one of frequency. How common is this disease? If you are shorter than average and you were not obviously malnourished as a kid, are you a victim of stress dwarfism? That's something else your parents did to you? No, this is not conventional stress. This is not, ooh, when I was a kid, we moved all the time, very stressful. This is not acrimonious divorce. This is nightmare psychopathology. This is the police and the social workers breaking down the door of the apartment and finding the child chained to the radiator, smeared in excrement, total nightmare stuff. And remarkably, get the child out of that setting, and there is recovery. And the general consensus in the field is this is a remarkably rare disease. This is a once-in-a-career disease to see, extremely rare. Except it's not so rare. It pops up all over the place. It pops up in areas of, perfectly logically, extreme stress. For example, a whole literature emerging about these poor kids who were raised in the Romanian orphanages shortly after the fall of communism there, and this was just the nightmare settings of kids like warehoused in these orphanages with incredible absence of stimulation and contact and affection, all of that, major, major impairment of growth. Okay, so that's one disturbing realm. But it pops up in other places as well. Here's a great historical factoid. King Frederick II of Sicily, some 13th century despot, who clearly was, you know, an early pioneering endocrinologist. I don't know what was going on in their court, but one day they were sitting around there having this argument about what's the natural language of humans. Presumably there was no villages to pillage and loot or whatever, so they were doing philosophy instead that winter, and what's the natural language, and they were holding out one for Greek and another for Latin or classical Hebrew, and presumably Frederick II of Sicily was holding out for Italian, and he did what was for the time a remarkable experiment. He got some children. He commandeered some children in his kingdom, and he had them raised in complete isolation for a number of years. Isolation like no one talking to them. Like whoever's giving them food runs in silently and leaves food for them, minimal contact with other humans. And the notion in this experiment was, at some point, they're going to open the door and out will come the child reciting in classical Greek or whatever is the natural language of humans. And eventually they opened the door and the kids did not come out speaking classical Greek. The kids did not come out at all. They had died from the extreme of stress dwarfism. So more examples of that, more examples where this comes up. Amid this picture of, oh, this is only at the great extremes, what you've got instead is a lot of cases where it does occur. One example, kids who grow up in areas, war zones, areas of civil strife, kids who grow up with all sorts of family dynamics that are highly stressful. Here's one really interesting example. This was a classic study done by a pair of anthropologists in the early 60s, looking at kids from different cultures and asking how physically stressful are the rites of passages in this culture. Rites of passages, you know, in some culture they scarification or piercing of body parts or tattooing or putting you out in the desert with poison ants. And in some cultures, you know, you have to play the piano for your grandmother and her friends. Whatever's done in your particular tribe. They did like 80 comparisons. They controlled for genetics. They did this perfectly. And what they showed was highly physically stressful rites of passages between ages 6 to 15 or so, 1.5 inches shorter as an adult. Let me tell you about the single creepiest example of stress dwarfism I've ever heard of. And if this doesn't unnerve you, you've got like no imagination at all. Here it is. If for some inexcusable reason you find yourself reading chapter after chapter about growth hormone, you're going to find this weird pattern, which is a lot of these chapters make reference to Peter Pan. Peter Pan like, oh, I don't know, Peter Pan, quotes from Peter Pan, snide comments about Tinkerbell. I'd seen this for years and I had no idea what was going on. Until one day, I'm reading a chapter about stress regulation and growth and the possibilities for stress dwarfism, gave the following case history, which is 8-year-old boy growing up in Victorian England. Perfectly comfortable middle-class family in the 1870s. One day, he sees his beloved older brother killed in front of him in an accident. This destroys the family. There were no other children. The father was like emotionally non-existent. This was the mother's favorite child in this Victorian swoon. She takes to her bed with the shades drawn for the next 10 years or so. Here's this child growing up in this complete emotional vacuum. And there's these terrible scenes where like he brings in a tray of food for his mother. And she's saying, oh, David, David, is that you? David, if you come to me, David, the dead son. And she'll go on, oh, David, are you finally, oh, it's only you. growing up being only you. Apparently, one of the only things that the mother ever talked to him about was this crazy idea that she grabbed onto, which was, if David had to die, he died when he was still my perfect little boy. He never grew up into a man who doesn't need his mother anymore. He'll always be my perfect little boy. He didn't grow up. This kid hears this with a vengeance. No evidence of malnutrition, no evidence of disease, stops growing at that point. Lives to 60 years of age, under 5 feet tall, dramatic effect, unconsummated marriage, and this winds up being a wild example of stress dwarfism. And then the chapter concludes by informing us that as an adult, this was the author of the much beloved children's classic, Peter Pan. This was J.M. Barrie, the author of Peter Pan. This was one incredibly messed up guy. This was a guy who just cranked out plays after novellas after about boys who die and come back as ghosts and marry their mothers and all sorts of stuff like that. His private journals were full of sadomasochistic fantasies with little boys. This guy spent the rest of his life not very effectively dealing with his stress dwarfism. So you may want to think about that the next time you see Johnny Depp up on the screen. But that's a case of one. That's a sample of one. What's the experimental evidence? Another remarkable example, a textbook example, where if you were working with lab rats, you could not have designed a better experiment. And this was in an orphanage in Germany shortly after World War II. A series of orphanages, in fact. And what was noted was the children in one of these orphanages had a very stunted growth rate compared to the other ones. And people went and studied, and what they thought might have been relevant was the woman running the orphanage, who was this cold, berating woman who had like zero physical contact with the kids. Okay, that's a nice speculation. Now what was done was the sort of thing that you could not have done any better with rats. The woman was transferred to a different orphanage, and suddenly the growth rates in that orphanage went down. Remember, everything's controlled for the kids, and all these orphanages are getting the same diet, the same number of doctor's visits, the same vaccinations. All that was different was this woman in charge. One additional wrinkle, which was, and she moved her favorites with her to each orphanage she was assigned to, and those favorites grew at a normal rate. This is a classic example, another one of those that winds up in every textbook. So based on this, suddenly there's all sorts of possible therapies that come to mind. And a remarkable one was worked out a few decades ago by a psychologist at the University of Miami named Tiffany Field. And what she did was notice one of the high points, one of the triumphs of modern medicine with a very major downside, which is you look at kids who wind up in NICUs, neonatal intensive care units, and they are taken care of in tubes and tests and monitors and all sorts of things. And in the process of that, there's one thing they don't have, which is a whole lot of physical contact with people. And Field came up with this idea, how about we go in and physically stimulate these preemies, these severe preemies, how about we go in and massage their backs? Massage their backs. How do you massage the back of a tiny preemie? You're doing it with your thumbs. And they went in and they did it 3 times a day, and they discovered something remarkable, which was there was about a 50% increase in the growth rate in the preemies who were stimulated in this way. The babies were more alert. They were more active. They went home at an earlier stage. And looking at them months later, their growth rates were still enhanced. This was a remarkable effect. And Field and the sort of people who have followed up on her work have done some estimates that if this were done in every neonatal ward in the country, it would save a huge number of lives. It would save billions of dollars in terms of the long-term adverse consequences of being an extreme preemie, a remarkable demonstration that get just the right amount of stimulation and growth is enhanced. Just as we've been seeing, get the wrong amounts into the stressful range and you disrupt normal growth. Now, all of this is about kids, but somewhere in there, we've got to think about adults, because by now I've noted growth hormone. Growth hormone has popped up a whole bunch of times in this course so far, and growth hormone, you secrete less of it during stress, all of that. What does growth hormone do? It makes you grow, which is what kids are about. But you look at adults, and they've got plenty of growth hormone in their bloodstream. And most of us as adults, we're not growing anymore other than wider as the years go by. What's growth hormone doing in the adult? And it turns out a very special role that at first was thought to have nothing to do with stress, but where the jury might be no longer out on this, which is what you do with growth hormone is remodel your bones. Now, most of us view bones as totally boring and nothing's happening there, and they just kind of keep your body together and bipedal and stuff like that. Bones are extremely dynamic parts of the body. You're putting in calcium, you're taking it out, you're remodeling. I mean, how else does somebody get bow-legged if you're not constantly remodeling your bones in response to the world around it? So what's doing the remodeling? You pull calcium out, you put it in. Growth hormone plays a huge role in depositing new calcium into bones. So along comes chronic stress, and it's not that you're a kid impairing growth, you're an adult. Growth hormone levels drop, and what might be the consequence of that? You are now depositing less calcium into your bones. So what's that going to set you up for? Brittle bones, prematurely aged bones, osteoporosis, and suddenly, in the realm of stress-related disease, there's this possibility that chronic stress can increase the risk of osteoporosis. Now, what the consensus was in the field until some time ago was, yes, 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 this is possible, but this is not likely to occur. You need such extremes of adult stress and such a collapse in growth hormone secretion that you never actually get overt osteoporosis. You may get the first little baby steps in that direction, but nonetheless, this is not a realm of stress-related diseases you need to worry about. And some years ago, it became clear that this wasn't the case. And this was work done by Carol Shively and Jay Kaplan at Bowman Gray Medical School, and they showed that there was a tragic, confused flaw in the whole biomedical literature built around doing this. And the flaw was as follows: the tendency of scientists to study male rats and male monkeys and male college students, and they're not all that representative of what animals are about, what humans are about, because it's losing half of the equation. Overwhelming, the literature was built around studies of males. Now, what happens when you're male and you're chronically stressed? As we know by now, up go glucocorticoid levels, down go growth hormone levels. And what does that wind up doing? Up increased glucocorticoid levels, you're pulling a lot of calcium out of your bones. Low growth hormone levels, you're not replacing it, and as we've seen, put those pieces together in the male rats, monkeys, etc., and you get just a hint of osteoporosis. Chronically stressed females, and something else happens. You've got the elevated glucocorticoid levels, you have the suppressed growth hormone levels, but as we are going to find out in the next lecture, something else gets suppressed, which are levels of estrogen. Now, amid all the controversies of hormone replacement therapy with estrogen postmenopausally, one thing that is absolutely clear is estrogen is very good for the health of your bones. Estrogen promotes calcium uptake. Estrogen is terrific in that regard. It decreases your risk of osteoporosis. That's great. So with females with chronic stress, instead of two things going wrong that puts you within the ballpark of osteoporosis, three things: elevated glucocorticoids, low growth hormone, and low estrogen, and suddenly you're more at risk for osteoporosis. At this point, the work of Shively and Kaplan have shown that this is precisely what's going on in lab monkeys and experimental monkeys, females with chronic stress, manipulating estrogen levels. Not quite clear in humans yet. The work is still going on in that area. Okay, so we've had this whole range of possible ways in which things can go wrong: prenatal stress, postnatal stress, effects on growth, how long-term are they, how common are these disorders of blunted growth in response to stress, what can be done about it perhaps, the field, Tiffany Field studies of intervention with extreme preemie kids. Lurking around in all of this here is the same sort of theme that was lurking around in the previous lecture, which is parenting style. And how does parenting style wind up influencing the growth rate? And for this, one has to get a sense of history and the history of what sort of parents have been advised to be. And for a gazillion generations, all of us grew up under the advice of Spock, Dr. Spock. Back around 1900, there was a different person who was the expert, a man named Luther Holt at Columbia University. And Holt was the most influential expert at the time teaching parents about parenting. And what he had to say was very different from a Dr. Spock scenario. He was the person of the school of spare the rod, spoil the child, children are meant to be seen and not heard. He even used phrases like referring to the vicious practice of picking up babies when they were crying and advising parents not to do that. This was an extremely stern view of what parenting should be. This was the dominant model at the time. And a number of decades later, with this remaining as the dominant model, along came a man who absolutely revolutionized this field, a man named Harry Harlow. Now, to appreciate what Harlow accomplished, you have to consider what were some of the dominant schools of psychology at the time. In addition to this whole view of people like Holt, of very stern, detached parenting styles, there was this school of psychology that dominated American psychology in the 20th century, the field of behaviorism. Best personified by the most famous behaviorist of all time, B.F. Skinner of Harvard. And in a totally simplified way, what was behaviorism about? You get rewarded for something, you're more likely to do it later. You get punished for something, you're less likely to do it. Positive, negative reinforcement, those are not exactly comparable to reward and punishment. Nonetheless, this general world of behaviorism, things that have good outcomes, you're more likely to do afterward, things with bad outcomes, less. So what would behaviorists have to say about this whole maturational process amid Luther Holt type advice? Somewhere up there comes this question, why do kids wind up getting attached to their mothers? Why do kids bond to their mothers? And you're a behaviorist, and you had the exact answer, which is you get attached to mom because she feeds you. You get positively reinforced. You get reinforced in those circumstances where you're sitting there saying, my gosh, I'm feeling a little bit hypoglycemic, and here's this breast belonging to mom, and soon I'm not so hypoglycemic. Why? I'll begin to have all sorts of positive feelings about this individual. That was the behaviorist view. Why do we get attached to mothers? Because mothers supply this essential need for nutrients. That was the dominant thinking at the time. And all you have to do is combine that with the sort of thinking in the Holt school of parenting style, and you come up with some pretty stern views, which is basically, as long as you provide a kid with food and adequate warmth and things like that, that's all you need to do. And remarkably, this dominated pediatrics at the time, hospital policies, pediatric boards, something that is inconceivable these days, which is your child winds up with some illness and is in a pediatric ward for a few weeks or so. And what was the rule at the time in most of these hospitals? Parents were allowed in for a few minutes a day. Perhaps parents were allowed in only for an hour a week, because after all parents do is mess up the process with the vicious practice of picking up their kids and coddling them. And what we've learned from Skinner and learned from the likes of Luther Holt is supply food, supply the right number of blankets, and that's all you need to do and be doing things correctly. So here comes the Harlow Revolution. Here's where this critical experiment was done that transformed how people think about the subject. One that winds up in every single textbook. I can almost guarantee you've seen one of the pictures from this experiment if you've ever taken Psych 101. This was this classic, brilliant experiment that Harlow did. He takes baby monkeys. baby monkeys being raised without a mother, a biological mother. And what they're raised with instead are two different types of surrogate mothers, substitute mothers for a real monkey mother. The first one was a tube of chicken wire with some styrofoam monkey head looking thing up on top and a bottle of milk sticking out of the chicken wire torso, roughly where the breasts are. Second surrogate, a tube of chicken wire with a monkey head on top and no milk, instead a warm terry cloth wrapped around the torso. So you ask the question, which of these two surrogate mothers is a baby monkey going to get attached to? And if you're B.F. Skinner, it's completely obvious what the answer is, and you would expect Skinner to very quickly be clutching the chicken wire mom with the baby bottle there, because that one supplies nutrients. And of course, you get attached to mom because she supplies you with nutrients. Look at a real living primate. Look at these baby monkeys, and they did something very different instead, which is, sure, they were willing to go on the chicken wire mothers with milk. They needed milk. Who were they attached to, though? Who did they spend most of their time on? Who, when something scared them, did they go scampering to for comfort? The warm mother with the terry cloth. It's not that you get attached to mom because she gives you an adequate number of calories. You get attached to mom because she makes you feel safe and makes you feel beloved. And what Harlow did was introduce a word into the technical scientific literature in his papers, the word love. You get attached to mom because she supplies things that are oh so much more important and fundamental and interesting than adequate calories and, you know, keeping your body at the same temperature that it's supposed to be. And out of Harlow's work came enormously important elaborations. One, a study, for example, that showed just how wrong the behaviorists were. Here, you've got the cloth mom, which a baby monkey is happy to hold on to, and what you've got is, in the middle of the torso, was a little spigot that could blast out, very briefly, a jet of air. Unpleasant, and not something you would want to stick around for if you're a behaviorist. And the rule that was set up was, when you clutch onto the torso of the mom, you get a blast of air coming out of the torso. Any behaviorist would have predicted at that point that what the baby monkeys are supposed to do is they stop clinging. And what they did instead makes perfect sense to anyone who has grown up and attached to anyone. The more they got blasted with the air, the harder they held on to mom. There's no positive, negative reinforcement world there of, oh, you get unattached to individuals blast you with jets of air. What we have here is remarkable insight into things like, why do we love people who mistreat us? Why do we make the wrong choices in that realm? And it's got to do with what it is we attach to. And what Harlow showed was, it's not about calories, it's about comfort and safety and love. Now, Harry Harlow's work has wound up being enormously controversial. And this was a man who has been just vilified in certain circles of research because he did elaborations on these studies that were brutal. Monkeys being raised in complete social isolation, monkey models of severe psychiatric disorders, extremely brutal stuff. And when I was a student first reading Harlow's work, I was horrified by some of it, not only the experiment, but an extremely callous style that he had in his papers. I was moved to tears by some of these studies, how awful they were. And perhaps relevant or perhaps not, Harlow sank into eventually fatal alcoholism amid all this, a very troubled man who did often some very troubling experiments. And you look at them and you ask what seems to be a perfectly obvious question. Didn't they know it worked this way? Didn't they know that baby monkeys, if raised in isolation, would wither away? Wasn't it obvious? Ironically, it took Harlow's work to show how unethical his own work was. You look at a baby monkey, and it's perfectly obvious what would happen if Harlow socially isolated them without a mom. If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you socially isolate us, do we not suffer? The point of Harlow's work was not that it showed the obvious, which is, if you socially isolate a monkey in early life, it's going to suffer. What he really showed was, if you do the same thing to a human, the same thing happens. And that sure wasn't obvious at the time.
Lecture 8, Stress and Female Reproduction.
Well, we are back again. I have a spanking new set of clothes, courtesy of the teaching company, all the way down to new socks, so I am just brimming with manly self-confidence, and thus am willing to tackle the issue of stress and female reproduction. Now, of course, you know the drill by now, which is going to be short term, running away from the lion, 30 seconds, got better things to do than thicken your uterine walls, long-term problem, chronic stress, and you begin to impair the reproductive system. Now, starting off, a great way to appreciate just how much this is one of those indulgences, reproduction, one of those ones that fall under the auspices of big, expensive, long-term, optimistic, and this is no time for it, is to appreciate just how expensive some aspects of female reproduction is. Best estimates are 50,000 calories that you go through over the course of a pregnancy, about 1,000 calories a day nursing, and this is simply something that's very tough to afford when you're running for your life. And in the face of chronic stress, this is the sort of realm that gets greatly impaired. And of course, you know where we go next with this, which is chronic stress in the form of psychological, psychosocial. It makes no sense at all for your body to say, oh my God, this is too expensive, let's defer until another period. Once again, you have that same logic that has haunted us in terms of stress-related disease. Real physical stressors, the stress response is wonderfully adaptive. Psychosocial stressors that we humans specialize in, and it makes no sense to turn on the chronic stress response, and this is one of the realms where you pay a price. Now, to appreciate it, we've got to tackle one of those endocrine axes, as talked about in the second lecture, have to tackle one of those pathways, which, as you recall, starts with the master gland, your brain, releasing a hormone that has something effect, that has an effect at the pituitary, which then, in this case, has an effect on the ovaries. Now, it's actually two different sets of hormones that wind up being relevant here. The first one, for the first half of one's reproductive cycle, known as the follicular stage. What you're doing there is you're maturing follicles, you're maturing eggs that will be released around day 14 of the cycle, and then you transition to what's called the luteal phase. Notion being, if conception occurred right around that 14th day, plus or minus a couple of days, what you now need to do is prepare your body, your uterus, for starting a pregnancy, implanting this fertilized egg. So what are the hormones involved? Follicular stage, that same axis again as promised, brain, pituitary, peripheral glands. You have, starting off, a hormone that lots of people are familiar with, coming out of the pituitary, luteinizing hormone. Luteinizing hormone, once again, do not write these down, do not panic if you don't know these terms and don't want to learn these terms. You got a hormone that comes out of the pituitary, which is going to stimulate egg maturation. And of course, what you know is the pituitary hasn't a clue when to release luteinizing hormone under the control of the brain, the hypothalamus, which releases the bizarrely named luteinizing hormone releasing hormone. So out comes this LHRH from the hypothalamus, has an effect on the pituitary, out comes LH, and you are now causing preparation for fertilization. You also are releasing follicle-stimulating hormone out of your pituitary, and collectively what LH and FSH are doing is maturing eggs and producing estrogen coming out of the ovaries plays a critical role in that. Now, once you transition over to the luteal phase, a different hormone dominates, and that's known as progesterone. And all you need to do to get a sense of what it's up to is progesterone progestational. What it does is prepare the uterus, thickening it, preparing it for implantation of the fertilized egg. Okay, so we've got all the basics of the system under our belt here, and what we now transition to, of course, is what's occurring during stress. What's occurring with this hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis? Now, what you see is a very complicated version of exactly what we know by now. first thing that happens, remember that hypothalamic hormone, luteinizing hormone, releasing hormone, the first thing that happens during stress is it releases less of the stuff. And that's occurring within seconds. Which hormones are responsible for that? You remember some of the dread names from earlier on, glucocorticoids. Glucocorticoids work up in the hypothalamus to inhibit the release of LHRH. Another hormone is relevant there, one that was mentioned for 1.5 seconds in that prior lecture, which now begins to be relevant for the first time, that hormone, beta endorphin. Beta endorphin, about the only thing that sort of registers with most people about beta endorphin is it's got something to do with blocking pain or runner's high, endorphin high. What's it doing instead working at the hypothalamus to block LHRH release? Very few hormones do only one thing. So this is another function of beta endorphin. Don't panic. Do not write these down. Again, get the general theme. So we've got the first thing that happens, which is decreased hypothalamic, decreased brain release of this LHRH. And by all logic, what that should now do is have a consequence at the pituitary. For lack of that LHRH stimulation, the pituitary is now going to be releasing less LH and FSH. But, oh, that's not enough. Your brain does not trust that things can be solved merely by shutting off LHRH secretion. Another thing that happens is you send signals, hormonal stress signals, you send signals to the pituitary to make it less responsive to whatever LHRH is coming out. And you could probably guess the mechanism by now. Just like every other hormone, LH, RH works by way of its receptor in the pituitary starts making less of these receptors. So you've got a double whammy there. Less of the signaling hormone is coming out of the brain, and the pituitary is less sensitive to that. So we know the consequence there already. There's going to be less LH, less FSH coming out, and thus the ovaries are going to be less stimulated to release estrogen. And once again, the same theme, just in case the pituitary is screwing up and still releasing some of that LH and FSH, the stress response, heavily glucocorticoids, are working down at the ovaries to make them less sensitive to LH and FSH. And you guessed that there are LH receptors in the ovaries and FSH receptors, and there's fewer receptors. So you've got less of the hypothalamic hormone, and the pituitary pays less attention to it. You've got less of the pituitary hormones coming out, and the ovaries pay less attention. And the result is lower estrogen levels and less likelihood of fertilizing an egg. Now, the next thing that kicks in is less progesterone. That's another step in the pathway. Those same stress hormones and the same ones begin to pop up over and over. Glucocorticoids, beta endorphin, they're also blocking the release of progesterone. And what you've got at this point is not only were you not releasing LH, FSH, estrogen, and maturing the eggs, but just in case against all these ridiculous odds, you somehow manage to get an egg that matures sufficiently through this follicular stage that it actually gets fertilized, what you've now done is you were making sure the uterus is not matured enough for this fertilized egg to implant. And the way you do that is exactly what we were just talking about. You secrete less of that progestational progesterone. You don't thicken the uterine walls, and it's less likely that the rare fertilized egg is actually going to implant there. One additional hormone that's going to become very relevant soon has a role in that, a hormone called prolactin. And we're going to see all sorts of things that prolactin does. One of the things it does in this case is it counters the effect of any progesterone that you still manage to dribble out despite the stress signals. What prolactin also does is thin out your uterine walls. So what should impress you by now is this is an incredible number of mechanisms for shutting down this reproductive ovarian axis at the level of the brain, the level of pituitary sensitivity, the brain signal, the pituitary ovarian sensitivity, all these steps. There's one really interesting additional step that comes in there, and it's got to do, oddly enough, with fat cells in females, and it's got to do with a very, very unlikely thing that females do, including human females, which is they secrete a certain amount of male sex hormones into the bloodstream. androgenic hormones like testosterone. Where are those coming from? From the adrenal glands. Remember, what the adrenal glands are up to is making adrenaline, epinephrine, glucocorticoids, and females, bizarrely, they also make adrenal androgens. Not a ton of this stuff, maybe 5% the levels you would see in a male. Nonetheless, you gotta get rid of this stuff. Unfortunately, as I noted there, fat cells come into play here, which is fat cells have this enzyme that could do like biochemistry 101. They could take the circulating testosterone and convert it to estrogen. That's great. Everybody lives happily ever after. You've turned these bizarre, unlikely circulating androgens into estrogen, and everything is working fine. But what if you're stressed? What if you're stressed like the locusts have come and eaten your crops and you've been subsisting on 1,000 calories a day? What if you were slowly beginning to starve? What happens? Your fat deposits begin to go down. You begin to get depleted of fat. You're starving. And what happens is after a while, you have too few active fat cells to do that testosterone to estrogen conversion. And at that point, you are up the creek for two reasons. First off, you're putting less estrogen into the bloodstream. That's not that much of a big deal. It's a tiny amount. But the biggest consequence is you're now not breaking down that testosterone. Its levels build up and mess up things at the brain, pituitary, all of that. So that's this weird from out of left field mechanism that's also relevant, this oddity of females making a certain amount of male sex hormones, and when you don't have much fat cells going there for you because of starvation, you don't do that conversion. So that's a major reason why starvation can shut down ovulation. That's also a major reason why voluntary starvation can do the same. Anorexia nervosa, one of its characteristics is that you shut down ovulation very early on. It's the fat depletion. That's also the reason why some women who do tons and tons of exercise will stop ovulating as well. Again, the fat deposit's going down. And this has actually been widely studied, the ratio of fat to muscle, the amount of fat stores, the readiness with which that conversion is going on. This has been studied in all sorts of cases. For example, in kids, prepubescent kids, most often studied in terms of girls who are very, very intense athletes, typically gymnasts, ballet dancers, the ones who are doing 6 hours a day. And what you will see is a very significant delay with the onset of puberty. And this was even shown a few years ago, a study of gymnasts from the Romanian Olympic gymnastics team. And those are those like 15-year-olds who weigh 60 pounds and are getting the gold medals. What was the average age at which these kids started menstruating? Approximately 19. Western average 12 and a half years. This is a huge effect in terms of delaying the onset of puberty. Once you've hit puberty, women who do tons of exercise, for example, runners, on the average, if you were running about 50 miles a week, that's typically when the fat deposits are getting below that threshold and you begin to have ovulatory problems. Now, I could be telling you the same exact story with males. Men who run that average of 45, 50 miles a week, typically there's a little bit of testicular atrophy, sperm count goes down. Okay, you were sitting there saying, wait a second, I thought exercise was good for you. Exercise is good for you. In fact, a lot of exercise is very good for you. That doesn't mean, though, that an insane amount of exercise is insanely good for you. At some point, you pass a point of optimal function. You pass a point of homeostatic balance, and too much of a good thing could be just as bad as too little. This winds up being very, very relevant. One of our themes again and again is optimal ranges, homeostatic balance. Okay, so what goes on at that point? What happens there is all sorts of problems with trying to make sense of this effect, trying to make sense of why the body is set up for responding to extreme athleticism. And what you've got is a theme we've had running through here. This is not typical. This is not typical for humans. Okay, how to get a sense of it? Sit down, some hunter-gatherer from the Kalahari Desert, and explain to them, you know, back where I come from, we have so much food and so much free time that sometimes we'll just go run 26 miles for the sheer pleasure of it. And they're going to say, are you out of your mind? This is stressful. I mean, throughout hominid history, if you're running 26 miles in a day, you are either very intent on eating somebody or somebody's intent on eating you. This is not normal hominid behavior. So again, we see the possibility of passing a point of homeostatic balance, a homeostatic ideal. Now, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, a very interesting hormone comes into play here, prolactin. Prolactin secreted during stress, and it turns out prolactin works, among other ways, by decreasing pituitary sensitivity to LHRH. It helps block the release of progesterone, all sorts of things like that. And as promised, prolactin is not merely a hormone released during stress. It does all sorts of other things. One interesting circumstance is if you have nipple stimulation, there's this neural loop going up to the brain and the hypothalamus, and you know that whole pattern, and out comes prolactin. Nursing causes prolactin release. And given all the things I just told you, prolactin release should be working as a contraceptive. Nursing is a contraceptive. That's why that works so well. Oh, you are sitting there saying, what does he know? He doesn't even have ovaries. Everybody knows nursing doesn't work very well. Nursing works wonderfully at being a contraceptive. The World Health Organization estimates there are more pregnancies prevented each year by nursing than by all other contraceptives put together. All you need to do is nurse the correct way, which I'm going to show you now. Aren't you folks who went for the audio version regretting it now? Okay, so what is human nursing like? Well, it depends. If you look at women in westernized countries, you see the following pattern. Typical pattern, you give birth, you nurse your child every couple of hours for 20 minutes or so. Typically, it begins to get lesser amounts of time. In the West, in the United States, women on the average nurse for 6 months. So what are you doing if every few hours or so you're nursing for 20 minutes? You begin to nurse, up go prolactin levels. You stop nursing, down they go. 2 hours later, up go prolactin levels, down they go. You get this scalloping pattern of prolactin up and down. That's not what humans and other primates normally do with nursing and thus with their prolactin levels. And to get a sense of that, this was first really studied in a bunch of hunter-gatherers, the folks living in the Kalahari Desert, the Kung Bushmen living in the Kalahari Desert, and they have a very interesting reproductive pattern, which is they have tons of sex, they don't use contraceptives, and despite all of that, women get pregnant about once every 4 years. What is causing that pattern to emerge? Now, the answer was very easy back then when people looked at hunter-gatherers and said, well, what's hunter-gatherer lifestyle like? Short, nasty, and brutish. They're all malnourished. They're all depleted of sufficient fat to ovulate. When people actually go and study hunter-gatherers, it becomes clear agriculture was one of the all-time stupid moves inventing that. Hunter-gatherers live very comfortably. As termed, they were the original affluent society. Folks like these are working 3-4 hours a day to get their day's calories. They are not short, nasty, brutish, and starving and depleted of estrogen. So what's actually going on there? What's going on was discovered a number of years ago by two anthropologists, Melvin Connor and Carol Werthmann, and what they did was they noticed the prolactin pattern, the nursing pattern, in women hunter-gatherers. And what you see there is something very different from in the West. Here's what happens. You give birth, and you nurse your child for 30 seconds. And 20 minutes later, you nurse your child for 30 seconds. And 20 minutes after that, and you do that around the clock for the next 3 years. You carry your child on a hip sling and nursing every 20 minutes or so. You nurse throughout the night so that the mother hardly even wakes up. The baby just sort of crawls over and does some nursing. Mom continues to sleep. Oh, of course, Connor and Worthman are there up at night with their like infrared goggles and stopwatches, but everybody else is undisturbed. And 3 years into it or so, your child is still nursing every 20 minutes or so. They come running in from the Little League day and game to nurse for a little bit. And when you have a nursing pattern like that, the first time you nurse for those 30 seconds or so, up go prolactin levels, and they're going to stay up for the next 3 or 4 years. That's the typical human and non-human primate pattern of nursing. And you do it that way, and you get this huge square wave nonstop of prolactin, you're not going to ovulate. That's what explains that delayed pattern of fertility. Think about that a second. Okay, what's the life history like for one of these women? Here's what you do. You hit puberty maybe when you're about 14 or so, typically a little bit later than in the West. And a year later, you're pregnant. And from what we just saw, 4 years later, you begin to ovulate again. Couple of cycles, you get pregnant again. 4 years later, couple of cycles. Eventually, you hit menopause and you suddenly realize, my God, over the lifespan of these women, they're having maybe a dozen periods. And you look at women in the West and